question of what happens after we die has intrigued humans for as long as we've been around.
As a physician, I know that most people don't think about death really until they're forced to.
Her brain was not functioning, and yet she had the most vivid experience.
That's a clip from the terrific new Netflix series, Surviving Death. Today on Skeptico, we talk to contributing producer and author of the original book, Leslie Kane. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today we welcome back, actually, journalist and author Leslie Kane to Skeptico. Leslie has an excellent new series out on Netflix titled Surviving Death. When I watched it, it was trending at number 6 on Netflix, which is just a huge accomplishment, particularly for a documentary of this type, you know, that's really packed with a lot of frontier science, important information. This is just a huge accomplishment. And you'll notice as you watch it, that she also appears in the film. And I got to say, Leslie, again, you do a fantastic job. I didn't know this is going to be in your IMDb database, right? This is your
on-screen.
No, it's really great. You have a great presence, and you add a lot to the production, which, again, not to just kind of go on and on, but the production quality of this thing is fantastic. It's so watchable. It's so cinematographic. And just a big congratulations on it. Before I leave this introduction, though, let me just let you know, if you don't remember Leslie's work, this is a very important journalist of our time. This is the person who broke the UFO disclosure story in the New York Times, which, as we've discussed, I mean, there's no way around it being one of the seminal events of, I don't know, history. I mean, the empire of the planet announces that we're being visited by aliens. At least that's my read of it, if you really are honest about what they wrote. She's the person, one of the people who has the byline in the New York Times, the newspaper of record. Leslie Kane is the one who wrote that. And of course, her credentials from the UFO standpoint stem from the book that she wrote in 2011, very, very influential book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. It was a New York Times bestseller. It was a big, big deal in the UFO community because it delivered what the title promises, that she got these guys to go on the record. I mean, major, major important people. And then, you know, we talked to her after that. In 2017, she wrote a book, and it's the book that this Netflix special is based on, Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for the Afterlife. And then just as we mentioned, you know, really check this out on Netflix. You'll really, really enjoy it. It's a great 6-part documentary series packed with just a ton of great stuff. So Leslie, again, congratulations on this. And thanks so much for coming on to talk about it.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you again. And I just want to, just jumping off what you said, I want to make sure it's clear that, I mean, this really isn't my series. This is a series that was based on my book, but it was made by a film company called Breakthrough Films. And, you know, I was a consulting producer. I had some input into it, but it's their creation on, you know, all the stuff you're saying about the cinematography and the beautiful way it's put together and the structure and everything else. The credit has to go to Ricky Stern, who is the director, and the other members of the crew that worked on it. So I just want to take my hat off to them because, as I said, it's not really mine, but it was based on my book. I had input into it. It was because of my book that it all happened. I take credit for that. And these filmmakers are just fabulous creative artists. And I just feel so fortunate that they were the ones. I don't think I would have wanted to do it with anybody else. This is a film company that I've worked with before, and they did a documentary for the History Channel in 2011 based on my UFO book. So now they're doing this based on my newest book. So I've known them for a long time, and they are really open-minded, gifted people. So I probably wouldn't have wanted to do it with anybody but them. And then they, of course, took the whole idea to Netflix. And that was incredible that Netflix was going to be the platform for it. So that's how it all happened.
Awesome. Awesomeness. I mean, love that you want to share the love. That's great. They deserve a ton of credit. Let's play a trailer for folks. If they're watching this video, they can see it, or just listening to it. Well, it's amazing. We'll listen to Jim Tucker here.
The question of what happens after we die has intrigued humans for as long as we've been around.
As a physician, I know that most people don't think about death really until they're forced to.
Her brain was not functioning, and yet she had the most vivid experience.
My near-death experience changes how I understand death.
We think these people, they're gone, but they're always watching after us.
Someone said, "What is your name?" This thing is talking to us.
The first story that Ryan ever told, he said, "Mom, I think I used to be somebody else."
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This is the biggest claim ever.
I don't believe we know everything.
Their loved one from the other side is there helping them cross over.
These signs and messages are always around us.
I would say, send me a cardinal when you get to heaven.
I can't explain it, but I know it was him.
If this is real, people should know. It'd change everything.
Okay, I'll end it there. So just, you know, great, great stuff. To tell folks, again, it's a 6-part series. You're being very modest, but it does follow the excellent research that you did for your book and the methodology that you have. I mean, you're a serious journalist, and when you approach these topics, you have that journalistic sensibility of, okay, what are my best sources? How do I build my case? And how do I present it as fairly as possible? And that comes through in the series.
I mean, there really wasn't any writing because there's no narrator. So the characters that are being portrayed and the people like Jim Tucker, the experts are telling the story themselves, which, you know, what was one of the things I love about it. I don't like narrators in documentaries particularly. So it was more about, I mean, the way it was shaped was there were just lots of drafts. You know, people would, they would go out and do a shoot, and then we'd talk about the structure of the particular episode. And there were it's like writing a book. There are so many drafts, you know, and the editing process is just, I don't know how they do it. I mean, the amount of footage that was shot for this series and that wasn't used, and the editors had to go through all of it and make this incredibly cohesive piece out of it. I really admire just the talent that went into this. In terms of the structure, I mean, for instance, having near-death experiences be the first episode, I think was really great because it's very just sort of expansive and beautiful to watch. It's fairly simple to understand, and it kind of gets people into sort of the positivity. I mean, there's some issues that come up with near-death experiencers, but you know, there's a lot of discussions we had about the order in which to present things, because in my book, actually the reincarnation stories were presented first.
Let's walk through some of these because people are going to find, people who listen to this show, they are actually going to be familiar with a lot of the cases. What's going to be especially compelling is, as you said, the way that you put it together, and as kind of a source where you can kind of corral in a family member or a friend and say, sit down and watch this, you know, all the stuff I've been telling you in bits and pieces, here it is put together.
Yeah. Okay. And of course I don't want to give everything away because I want people to see it, but you know, the show opens with the case of Dr. Mary Neal, who, you know, a lot of your audience may be familiar with her story because she's been out in the media before. But what was so compelling about it was she's a very highly educated medical doctor. And she was literally drowned for literally 30 minutes. She was under the water. I mean, it is just, you know, you don't live through something like that. Yet she was able to come back, and she had a very, very vivid NDE, and she was in the hospital for 3 months after and had to have all these surgeries. And then when she first got there, the doctor said, There is 0% chance that she will not be brain damaged from this, yet she wasn't. So, you know, it's just a highly evidential case. When the cases are documented by the doctors who actually have witnessed the way the person was, the state of death that that person was in, and yet they come back, and they come back with conscious experiences that they had when they had no brain or no heartbeat, when they were basically dead. How can you explain that? That's what's so interesting about it.
Well, in her case, one of the aspects of it that is just particularly kind of next level spiritually challenging is she comes back with the information that her oldest son.
I don't know if you should give that away, should you? For people
Leslie,
who haven't seen it?
Leslie, they are going to want to go and watch this show. Do you think this little.
I know.
And she said that before. Again, as you said, you know, it's not.
I guess it's not brand new. Yeah, I was just wondering, because when I first saw it, I didn't know that was coming, because I didn't really know the case. And it was like really hit me when it came. So I don't want to. But if you don't think it's an issue,
I'm saying it. You can't resist it.
Because
it does really hit you on that next level. I mean, because if we're just going to kind of talk kind of freely, like I like to do, you know. The series is great, and you have to do what you just said, that isn't this amazing that scientists are finding out that consciousness survives death. That is fantastic, but there's a yada yada aspect to that for people who've been around it for a long while.
Right.
When you get someone like this, who is a medical doctor, is now just kind of sheepishly going, yeah, everything I thought I knew is bullshit, but I have to kind of continue to kind of say that. And then she says in the most profound, heartfelt way, because her connection with her son was obviously very deep and is still very deep. And she comes back from her NDE saying she was told that her son will pass. And they just tell her exactly, because it turns out to be a slightly different, but they tell her when that's going to happen. And the challenging thing about that, obviously for us, is it zooms way past the, gosh, you know, the Scooby-Doo kind of pull off the mask at the end. Are the doctors right or wrong? It's to, is anything in this existence what we think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It is really raises a huge amount of questions. And, you know, the other question it would raise is, if indeed there were beings there, which is the way she described it, who were imparting this information to her, why would they even tell her this? You know, she had no idea. Just putting aside the profounder questions that you raised about what it means about our existence, it's also like, you know, she never really understood why she was given this information. And she had to live with it every day of her life. And her sense was that he was going to die at a young age, you know? And so by the time he was 18, she was ecstatic that maybe it wasn't going to happen, but then of course it did. So that's another question. And I think what's interesting about the way the filmmakers portrayed, dealt with NDEs in the whole first episode is they didn't only show the sort of glorious, you know, aspects of it, which is what everybody thinks of as an NDE. There are struggles that go along with it. And when we went to Seattle to be with Kimberly Clark Sharp, who counsels these people, we learned that there's a lot of struggles and difficulties that they have. And I don't see that also is an aspect that I haven't seen covered in most documentaries that are very kind of woo-woo about, oh, they go see Jesus and they're happy for the rest of their lives because they're not afraid of dying. You know, it's not that simple. And I like the fact that we open up the door to complexities around it.
Yeah, that integration problem is really kind of an issue. And it seems to be a broader issue with this understanding of extended consciousness that the whole series deals with, right? So you look at integration problems in NDE, but you also have integration problems with people who have an extreme encounter with a ghost encounter or just a spiritually transformative experience, which isn't so much about the film, but it is. And then you have the denial of the integration problems, like in reincarnation. I love the clip when Ryan's dad, and Ryan is the kind of famous story of the Hollywood kid, right?
Sure. I mean, episode 5 is about, like you saying, sort of ghosts and apparitions. And then that moves into end-of-life visions or end-of-life experiences. So this is people who are consciously dying. They're not on drugs, you know, they're dying, they're in hospice, but they're awake and alert. And the kinds of visions that they have in which they experience their loved ones who have already passed on coming to assist them with crossing over. That's sort of the theme. And we went with a hospice doctor named Christopher Kerr, who's in Buffalo, New York. And I thought the segment was absolutely beautiful. I was not part of that. That's the filmmakers handled that whole thing. I mean, I didn't research it. I didn't meet Dr. Kerr. And I think they did a fantastic job. And it's just very moving, but it also opens you up to the possibility that when you're close to the end and you sort of have one foot in that world, you're going to be, there's some spillover into your world, you know, and these people have these experiences, and to them, they're very real, and they help them die within peace and with, you know, a sort of an awareness that there is something else coming along. And Dr. Kerr has been documenting these cases for many years. So I found that that's what Five is basically.
I thought the segment with Dr. Christopher Kerr was absolutely amazing. And I think other people will find it just
stunning, really, wasn't it?
Stunning and challenging on a number of different levels. I mean, the guy just seems transformed by his experience with this data, which I think is all of us who, you know, I haven't had a near-death experience. I don't know anyone. I'm kind of spiritually dense, but I soak this stuff in and I look at the work of somebody like Christopher Kerr, and I go, wow, you know, we can be transformed. Anyone who watches this series can be transformed by seeing how these people are transformed, how their life has changed. I love the story of Dr. Kerr, how he says, you know, he was just a regular doctor, if you will, you know, believing all the bullshit that doctors are told. And he recounts this in the series. He goes, I was in and I was visiting a patient of mine who was in the advanced stages of AIDS. I had gone through his medicals and had come out and told the nurse, yeah, he's got about 3 or 4 more days. You should get da. And she's just nodding her head, writing. She goes, no, actually, he's going to be gone really quick.
The reason she knew that was because she said he was being visited by,
exactly,
you know, these nurses who are the ones that are with the patients, not the doctors. They know when certain things start to happen, they know what the pattern is because it happens all the time.
Exactly.
You know, it's just fascinating. And then he jumped in himself and he started to enter into that world himself. And he was transformed by that.
It's exactly as you say. And what I love is the little clip he goes, you know, I realized at that point when I look back that I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And that, you know, I've interviewed people in hospice before and people who've worked in hospice. And there is just a wealth of information, as you're alluding to, among those people. They just know this shit and they can't talk about it because they're bound by a medical system that is in complete about orchestrated denial about all this stuff, but they know this stuff, you know, so anyways, this guy, as you see in the film, is transformed by this and is now in service to people. And he's doing it with the stethoscope around his neck. But what he's really doing is what, Leslie? I mean,
he visits these people. A lot of them are in their homes. And he just talks to them and listens. That's what he does. And it means everything to these people. And he keeps records so that, you know, there is a research process. There's a database but the main thing is the human contact that he provides them and the validation of their experiences, that they're authentic, that they're real, that they're meaningful. And he likes to hear about them from people. And I think, you know, it's so moving in the series to be able to see the interaction that he has with these people. You know, it's so intimate, it's so meaningful, and it's very emotional. I found that whole segment to be very emotional. There's a mom who had lost her little girl, you know, and you hear from her, you know, and what the girl was saying and how it's affected the mother. And there's just a lot of the whole series really is about the personal experiences of regular people who have lost loved ones, and in various different scenarios, in various different ways, they're asking the questions and they're finding ways to connect with their loved ones once they've passed, you know, that's really, it's, and I think that it's so much about that. It's about what people go through when they're asking questions about life after death and they're coping with it. And there's nothing sad or really morbid about it, but it's meaningful and moving. You know, for instance, the couple that you, in the previous episode about that grief retreat, remember this, that couple who had lost their son in the Boy Scout accident? I mean, I found that to be the most emotionally wrenching, but uplifting at the same time, but just to the raw grief that they were able to expose to our crew, and then to have something happen to them that really helped them. It was just, you know, it's very emotional, the whole thing. But it's really about people, as much as it is about research, which, as you point out, is an important part, and it's sort of in the background. But I think what these filmmakers like to do when they make movies is to focus on, they call them character-driven movies. They like to tell stories about people. And I think that's a lot of what the emphasis is in the series overall. You're going on these journeys that people are going through, and there, a lot of the times it's people who weren't asking for anything to happen or weren't looking for it. You know, if you have a near-death experience, you're not looking for that. They just happen to people, just like everyone, like you and me. And I think episode 6 is probably the closest one to my book, where we have three cases of these young children who remember their past lives, and Jim Tucker is there. And he's investigating the cases, and they're, you know, that's a little more scientifically oriented.
Remind people who Jim Tucker is.
Jim Tucker is a child psychiatrist. He's with the department or the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. And this is an amazing place. I recommend that everybody go to the website of it's abbreviated. We call it DOPS, D-O-P-S. And look at what they do. There are a group of scientists there, a large group of them, who look at all these things. And Jim is particularly focused on reincarnation cases. And he is following in the footsteps, or I should say, he really has his own footsteps now, but he took over the work of Ian Stevenson, who was another psychiatrist who worked for decades. He was really the one that brought these cases into the world. I mean, he spent decades traveling around the world documenting cases of young children who remember very specific details about previous lives, things they were not exposed to and couldn't possibly know. And so he's written volumes and volumes of case studies on these.
I just interject, people probably know this, but one of the little points that's interesting, and it is nicely done in the series again, is that the work originally began, one, he got a grant from I think the Polaroid or Kodak family,
or
I forget.
Xerox.
Yes, you're exactly right. From the Xerox guy. I forget his name. Yeah. And then he goes over to countries where reincarnation is accepted, right? So he goes over to Sri Lanka, India, and stuff like that, where they're more likely to be collecting these stories. And he brings his very Western scientific approach, but then he does this. And then the other research that him and Jim eventually get into is even physical evidence of that people who know this research, it's incredibly compelling that where there's actually an injury, you know, oh, I was shot in the chest the last time I die. Oh, there is a birthmark right there in my chest or whatever. So there's, again, this super impressive work. And then I just want to emphasize what you said. Jim Tucker is a star, and he's a
great
star academically, intellectually, but also he's another guy like this Dr. Kerr figure that you just think there's a lot going on here at a deeper spiritual level in terms of what he's bringing to the world, the light, the love, the comforting that he's doing shit on a much more powerful spiritual level that we can all see right below the surface, but we like that he's presenting it in a very straightforward, here are the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, well, two of the first case is a new case, actually, and that didn't, you know, there wasn't as much data on that case. The case of a mom in Indiana and her little boy named Atlas. And, you know, what's fun about it is that we see Jim going to her house, meeting her for the first time, doing the processes that he does when he investigates a case. And that it's not like it was fully fleshed out.
Well, describe that scene. It's fantastic. I mean, she Googles this information, then Jim comes in. And what does he do? How does he do the quote unquote test?
Well, he has, and this is similar to what he did with Ryan Hammonds years ago. He has a kind of a photographic test. So this little boy remembered being another boy who was actually died as a small child. So he wasn't very old when he died, but he remembered the name of the child, the name of the mom. And so Jim brought in a bunch of photographs, and he brought five sets of photographs in. And each one had two different images. So five sets of two images, and they were very similar to each other, the two images. So one of them, for instance, was a playground, which was right next, very close to where this boy in the previous life lived, because the little Atlas had said he used to go to the playground. So he would show him like two pictures of the playground, of the real playground, and then another playground that looked a lot like it. And he did this for five times. He also included a picture of the previous parent, mom, the previous dad, you know, things that they're like, it's like a recognition test, almost like what the Tibetan Buddhists do, you know, only with these photographs. And it was amazing to watch Atlas, you might agree, Alex, how just, and Jim commented on this, he was just so like, boom. There was no need to figure anything out. He just, that one, you know, he would right away, he knew which was the real one, the one he recognized. And in all five of them, he got them right. And Jim comments afterwards that, you know, five out of five is pretty significant. It really means something. And he was also commenting just as a psychiatrist, a psychologist, just how much confidence the boy had and how sure he was of everything he pointed to. There was no hesitation. There was no, let me see, you know, none of that. So that was really a wonderful thing to film and to watch.
It was a wonderful thing to watch for me. It was just, again, the subtext of it is as exactly as you described. One, Jim Tucker is just, he's just a guy that's operating at a much deeper level. So he's talking about five out of these photos. He's not trying to convince you of the statistical significance. He's more pulling you in than the way that you said it. Did you see the boy's reaction? Did you see how he responded to looking at that photo of his mom? And he's a little bit sheepish about it because he knows his quote unquote mom is here. And he says his old mom and, you know, all the stuff that you can, it's next level stuff, people, in terms of what reincarnation, we don't know what reincarnation is. We don't know what reincarnation means. We just know the profound experience that this guy's had. And add to, you know, the other little cultural aspects. The previous boy died tragically in 2005, and Atlas is born in 2011. So what does that mean in terms of reincarnation? He, you know, I love the racial implications, right? The boy was an African-American kid in Brooklyn, and he can't be a whiter guy with it. And he says, he initially says to his mom, I love this. Imagine if you're this kid's mom. And he goes, yeah, I really miss going to the park, like you said, the playground.
Right.
Goes, oh, really? You mean when I took you to the playground? And he goes, no. My mom with the really pretty hair.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's got to be hard to listen to, no matter reincarnation or not.
And that was mild compared to what some parents have had to deal with, you know, in these really, really intense cases. But yeah, and then when Jim Tucker was interviewing the little boy Atlas, and he pointed to the picture, he says, that's my mom. And then Jim says, oh, you mean this mom? Or, you know, your mom here? And he goes, no, my other mom. My old mom. He says, no, my old mom. It's just chilling to see that happen. This child is just being totally genuine in the moment, you know? So it was amazing because we didn't have any current case for a while. We were hoping so much to have a something to be able to include that was happening now and that we could bring Jim in on it. And fortunately, this case happened for us. So it's just such a beautiful way to open up that episode, because after that, we go into these two other cases that have been thoroughly researched and have a lot of data and a lot of complexities and lasted for years and really affected the parents and, you know, just more intense than the one. And we went and revisited the boys now as 15-year-old and 21-year-olds, these two famous cases, which I think is the only time they've ever really gone on camera like this for, you know, anything.
Compelling stuff. Again, for people who followed any of this research, that interview with Ryan when he goes out to LA, please set that up because we have talk about it, because I think it's super important on this next level kind of thing.
I mean, that was an awkward scene in LA, very complicated. But anyway, Ryan, so I wrote about this case in my book in some detail, and he was, when I covered it in my book, of course, I just spoke about it, him as a five-year-old, a 4 and 5 and 6-year-old was when all this stuff was happening. And just to summarize it, he basically had 55, literally 55 memories of this previous life that were able to be verified as accurate. So it was a long process to find who he was in the previous life.
But tell the story. Tell the story again for folks who don't know. It's a great story.
Yeah, I mean, so he started to tell his mom that he remembered being somebody else, and that he lived in Hollywood, and he had a house, and he had all these kids, and he had a swimming pool, and lots of different details. And he would wake up at night crying, and he missed his old mom. It was very emotional. And so his mom didn't know what was going on, but she started to think maybe this was some kind of past life thing. And she read that, well, if they're connected to it in some way, it might help calm them down. So she went out and got all these books about Hollywood out of the library with all these pictures of Hollywood, because he'd go crazy when he saw the big Hollywood sign, you know, on the TV or something. And so they would just flip through these books at night. And one night he pointed to this still from a 1932 movie called Night After Night. And he pointed to one of the people, and it had five guys in it. And there is, if people have my book, I have this picture in my book. But he said, "That's me, mommy." And he pointed at one of the characters, and he pointed the other one and said, "That's George. And we made a movie together." So it turns out that it was George, I forget the last name, a famous actor of the time. That was correct. There wasn't even a caption on the picture, and the kid couldn't read, but you know, if people need to hear that. But the man that he pointed to, he was just an extra. He had no lines in the movie. So they couldn't figure out who the guy was. They looked online, they just couldn't figure it out. And so eventually, his mom wrote to Jim Tucker, and she started to keep a record of everything that Ryan would say, because he had a lot. He was doing a lot of memories, you know, and she would every day write them down. And she had this long journal. It was about this, she called it her journal, about this thick. And she would send these things to Jim Tucker that her child said. So they were dated. There was a record that this expert had. So nobody could say, well, she figured out who it was first, and then she went back and, you know, embellished it or anything. She had no idea. She just sent the memories off. And eventually Jim Tucker went out and met the family, and through a long process, they were able to get an archivist from this huge film library in LA to go into the archives and look up this movie, which was called Night After Night. And in that file, there was a picture of the guy he had pointed to with his name on the back of the picture. And his name was Marty Martin. And so once they had the name, they were able to do all kinds of research on him. And they found out that 55 of, you know, through all kinds of travel documents, newspaper articles, here's an example, Alex. You know, Ryan always said he worked for an agency. He was an agent. He wanted to play agent. He worked, and they all thought, oh, he has some fantasy that he was part of the CIA or something. You know, they just thought, oh, yeah, he must be talking about maybe it's imaginary, maybe not. But he kept saying he was an agent. And he said, and in my agency, we change people's names. We change people's names. So when they figured out who Marty Martin was, right, it turned out that he ran a talent agency in LA. There's even stationery. It says Marty Martin Agency. And they would change people's names because they were actors trying to have these stage names. So, you know, there's a process where all these things were verified. And then the interesting part, which leads to what you were asking about the series, was finding the daughter of Marty Martin. Now, Marty Martin died, I believe it was 1965. Which was another element that Ryan kept insisting that he died in 1965, but the birth certificate said 63, or the death certificate. And he would say, no, it was 65. And they were all saying, no, it was 63. And then Jim found, and I helped find some of this stuff, some additional documents, and including a photograph of his grave eventually that revealed that actually Ryan was right, that it was 65, which was another interesting thing. But anyway, so they found the daughter of Marty Martin. So he had a daughter who died when the little girl was 8 years old when her father, Marty Martin, died. Now she's like in her 60s. And she was very close to her dad. And of course, it was traumatic when she lost her dad. So, I mean, I actually was the one that reached out to her initially because I'd reached out to her at the time I was writing my book, actually. And we had a good connection. And, you know, I thought she's never going to want to go on camera because they had gone out once before for another series, tried to film a scene with her. Ryan freaked out when he was 5. She didn't want to go in camera. The whole thing was kind of a bust. So now here was Ryan, now 15 years old. And we wanted to take the family back to meet her, you know? And so that's what we were able to set up and do. Her name's Marisa. Lovely, lovely person. But, you know, she didn't know what to make of this, right? And the other person that came on this in the scene was Marty Martin's niece, who was significantly older than Marisa. So she knew Marty as an adult, whereas Marisa only knew her dad until until she was 8 years old. So in some ways, the niece, Tony, knew Marty even better than Marisa did. So we had the two of them there in LA. Ryan and his mom went to the home where Marisa lives, where there's all this Marty Martin stuff all over the house, you know, pictures, ashtrays with his initials on them. There was a hat that has, and he had everything monogrammed, you know, just stuff everywhere. And so that's probably what you were talking about. You see, and you know, Ryan is, he's kind of uncomfortable. He's 15 years old. He's trying to live a life as a normal kid.
It's not a fucking circus act. That's what I took out of it, is like the movie, the film series is going down two parallel tracks, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what's really profound about it. One is the evidential track, you know, here's the evidence you should believe. Here's the evidence you should believe. And at some point you go, fuck that. Here are the people who are experiencing what it means to come to this fundamental realization about who they really are. Hats off to Ryan. Ryan is not performing a fucking circus act.
He's deeply
trying to process the fact that he lived, whatever that means, this previous life. So no, he isn't, you know, and he's nice about it. He goes, you know, I'm not sorry, I can't give you what you want, but I can't give you what you want. This is real. It's like the other point we talked about integration and the near death and the crisis. It's all that stuff. That's what's beautiful about this series, is let's get past this hokey evidential stuff and get to the point where we go, okay, this is real. Now, how do we deal with it? How do we integrate it? These people are trying to integrate it. And I think they're also showing us that we need to integrate this information.
Right. I think you're right. And I don't think it's really saying, when it shows the evidence, we're not saying believe it, or we're trying to prove anything, but we are laying out the case about, you know, why is this a valid case of a child reincarnation? So just to show, but it's really about, that's sort of the background, like you're saying. It's really about, where are these people at now and how does it affect them and how are they processing it? Just like you said. And what is it like for this 15-year-old to meet his daughter from a previous life? I mean, the whole thing is just like, whoa, you know? And it was very bizarre because nobody really knew what to make of it. Everybody was sort of plopped down in this very sort of uncomfortable, unusual, exploratory situation, not knowing what was going to happen. And Ryan and his mom visited Marty Martin's grave for the first time ever. And that's another bizarre thing. What is it like for a 15-year-old to look at the grave of who he remembered being in a previous life? And he remembered it so strongly. Now he doesn't remember that much because, I don't know, maybe people know that normally these young children with these memories will start to forget them at around the age 6, 7, 8. They just forget these memories and they go on and live their lives. So, you know, Ryan, it's not like he carries the memories in his brain anymore. He knows what he remembered at the time. But still, to be standing there and looking at that stone with the name Marty Martin on it for the first time, you know, and he's quiet. You don't really know what's going on with him. But I agree with you. It has this very provocative, emotional, you know, mysterious quality to the whole thing. And he's only 15. So what does someone at that age do? I remember Offset, you know, he was texting his girlfriend. He just wants to live his life, but he's got this amazing aspect to his life. And he was willing to step forward in front of the cameras and go through this process with us. And I just thought it was amazing.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, we're all just trying to live our lives, right?
And true.
I think that's what the series is about, is like, are you really living your life with your eyes really open to what's around you? Or are you living your life with your eyes closed because that's what feels comfortable? It's comfortable to right. feel like, when that little doctor walks into your room really is going to tell you the whole thing. And it's great when Dr. Kerr says, yeah, I realize I don't know shit. I realize everyone's looking up to me and I don't know shit, you know? And so that's where I think if we allow ourselves, that's where I think the series takes us, is to reexamine our own, you know, approach to this.
I'm so glad, yeah, that it had that effect. I mean, because it's, you know, I was so involved that it's hard. You're somebody who just got to watch it. It's right. hard for me to sort of look at it from a perspective that you have. And I'm really glad that it had that, made that impression on you.
What are some other of your favorite segments?
I'll tell you what I loved is the Cardinal. You remember the Cardinal?
Yeah, the Cardinal's pretty good. But I got to pull you to where people are going to react to the trans mediumship and the physical mediumship, because it's the one place where there is the doubt, you know, it's sure. not as clean as the rest, which is okay. That's part of the process. So I guess we should talk about that as well.
Well, I mean, it was very hard. You know, I really kind of don't want to go into that too much because of it's complicated for me personally. And there are certain things in that, and these were two episodes in which we covered mediumship. And I had ideas about how I would have liked to have covered it that didn't necessarily agree with the filmmakers. Now, it's hard for me to talk about that too much, as you can imagine. I have the greatest respect for them. But I would have included certain things and not included other things that were there.
We'll leave it there because I appreciate yeah. what you're saying. And I don't want to stir up too much because now everyone's going to be interested in that. And there's nothing really bad about it, and it's well done for what it is, but I yeah. do get what you're saying. People will find it to be a little bit out of sync with the very straightforward approach they have. Let's do this as we kind of wrap it up. I want to kind of mm-hmm. tie this back a little bit to the other area of research work, investigative journalism that you're known for, and that's the UFO field, because there's a slight tie-in in the series that you don't really trace down too far because it wouldn't totally be appropriate. But Bud Hopkins, do you want to talk about?
That's
do you
funny.
Want to talk? Yeah, you want to talk about that? And who is he? And what do you mention in the series about?
Yeah,
you
know? It's interesting because I never thought of that as really being. I think of him more as a person rather than as UFOs. You know, because so Bud Hopkins was. I'm sure a lot of people know the name. He was a well-known researcher of abduction, UFO abduction cases. I mean, basically, Bud Hopkins, John Mack, and David Jacobs are sort of the people that were prominent in this research during the years that I was studying it. He wrote the book Missing Time and Intruders, witnessed a bunch of books. So I became very close to Bud in the last maybe 5 years of his life or something like that. And I actually helped see him through a whole lot of medical issues that he had. And I was, you know, he had cancer and he had other issues and he was in hospice for a few weeks at the end of his life at home. And I was actually present at the moment he died. I was there with his daughter and his daughter's husband and myself. And, you know, I do mention this in the series that it was just a very profound experience. I'd never been with somebody before at that moment. And it's just sort of a mind-blowing, I don't know if you've ever had that experience, Alex, but to be there and have this alive person, although, you know, they're kind of going out gradually, but they're still there. And then they're suddenly just gone. And it's almost surreal. You just don't get how this could possibly happen. Like, this, how could this person just disappear? It's very hard to describe. It's like you're, it's a surreal kind of very kind of almost mystical experience. It was for me. And the atmosphere in a home when somebody is in hospice and it's managed properly is very quiet. It's almost like, you know, when you walk in the door, it was almost like going to a church kind of environment. It was very quiet and deep, and you're kind of confronting, you know, the real mysteries of life. And so here you watch this process happen, and suddenly this person is just this physical material thing who's taken out in a bag, you know, and you're just like, what is going on here? So it really, it was provocative for me, and it made me want to understand what this process of death is all about. Is there something else that's going on? How could he just disappear? I don't think he did just disappear. Something else must be going on. So it was sort of a, although I was already really interested in this stuff before I even met Bud, I studied a lot of, especially in the reincarnation cases, but it was really sort of a jolt for me on some kind of gut, non-intellectual level to want to understand this better.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to, it's your experience and it shall remain your experience the way that you tell it. But I can't help but see all these unbelievably, incredibly synchronistic people that probably don't understand fully who Bud Hopkins is, because you would have had to have lived through that. You know, I just interviewed and published an interview with Whitley Strieber, who I thought was, you know, continues to be just an incredibly important person.
He is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. Know, I go on his show a lot. I think he's terrific. Yep.
Yeah. And you've done some, he's done some great interviews with you on his Dreamland show.
He's just an amazing human being.
Well, so back to Bud Hopkins, because the people who don't know, and you can fill this in better than I can, you know, but when Bud Hopkins goes public with this stuff, that is, you know, following up on the work of Harvard psychiatrist John Mack, who almost loses his position at Harvard because he says, I'm just an honest scientist and I've been interviewing these people who claim to have had an abduction experience with these ETs, and I find no reason as a professional to doubt anything they're saying. And moreover, there's a spiritual aspect to this that I can't get my arms around completely. And Bud Hopkins comes along and says, well, what Bud Hopkins says is get ready, because I've done a bunch of these regressions with these people. And a lot of people still don't understand that regression is real and hypnosis really can recover memories, and there can be false memories, but there also is a lot of memory recovery. And that's why police departments around the world use it. And, you know, witnesses come back and they remember stuff that they didn't remember, and the cops later corroborate what their memories are. So, you know, all this bullshit that's been smeared mainly because of certain groups of people who are implicated in crimes, they've kind of created this false memory syndrome bullshit. Not to get too far off the trail, Bud Hopkins says this research is going to trigger a lot of experiences, and it does. Thousands and thousands of people start coming forward and saying, oh my God, now that you mention it, yeah, I was abducted. And there's this whole movement to kind of discredit that because, for whatever reason, but most likely they, whoever they is, didn't really want that to come out quite that way at that time. But Bud Hopkins is really an important figure in this whole disclosure process, because, and I was talking with Whitley about this, it transformed the thing from a nuts and bolts, there's a craft in the sky, to a consciousness phenomenon.
Right.
Lo and behold, I mean, Leslie, that's what you've been pursuing ever since. That's what this series is all about. It's about,
except not with respect to UFOs. I've always kept them separate, you know?
Yes. Right? Okay. Okay. All right. All right. So I won't push that
professionally,
too far.
Professionally, I have to do that. If I'm going to write for the New York Times, you know, I'm writing about what the Department of Defense says about the latest video that, you know, or what the head of the program says, blah, blah. But that doesn't mean I'm not really interested in exploring that connection. There is a connection somehow, and Whitley talks about it all the time, between the UFO phenomenon, or at least the impact it has on people and the journeys that people take, and what we might call some kind of afterlife realm, or, you know, where deceased people go. So, I mean, Whitley to me is the person who has spent the most time with this and has had the most direct experience of it. But I'm fascinated by that question of how it all goes together. But I don't think I'll be reporting on that very much in the New York Times, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. But you already did, you know, I mean, see, we'll leave it at that. But I mean, you dropped that into the series.
Well, the Bud Hopkins bit. Yeah. I mean, it just so happened that he was the guy that really triggered a lot of this. Yeah. I hadn't thought, you see a level of things through all of this that I don't, you know, I think is really, really a great contribution you're making, because I don't think a lot of people see beyond the surface level. And I didn't see a lot into that until you brought it up. So I think I love everything you've said about how, like Jim Tucker, you can just see that there's more going on with him. I mean, it's great that you're able to go to that level with this. I really value that.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I think you're doing it. I think you're doing your work the way you do your work, because that's who you are. I mean, that's Leslie Kane, and that's an important contribution in this. So we're all looking at it, you know, looking at the elephant a different way. What you're contributing here, again, folks, it's stunning. You just have to watch it. I think you know, it's not like you have to watch it like it's homework. You have to watch it because you'll really, really enjoy it on so many different levels. It's, again, the series is called Surviving Death. It's on Netflix. It'll probably pop up there right on top because it's one of the top 10.
Well, it was number 4 yesterday in the U.S.
Woohoo! Congrats!
Yeah, so, you know, and if people, you know, if I have a Facebook page and I have lots of people that interact and comment on Facebook, so if people want to interact or comment or critique it or whatever, invite them to come onto my Facebook page and I will respond eventually.
Great. Yeah. That is fantastic. And so, Leslie, what else is going on? I always hate to say this because you're right in the middle of it, but I mean, what is next, either with this project or another project that you're working
on? I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a possibility. We don't know what's going to happen with this. We would, of course, all of us would love to do a season 2. We've been saving files and cases and notes and interviews that, you know, we've done and so on to try to put together a season 2 if that's offered to us. So, and people have already been asking, where's season 2? You know, this thing hasn't even been out a week yet.
Top 5. So,
it's already doing really well. So, you know, if Netflix is interested in a season 2, we will definitely do it. So we just don't know yet on that score. And I've got other projects I'm involved with. You know, at the very beginning of projects, you can't really discuss them until there's a certain point where you can. So there's one thing I'm doing that I can't discuss. And there's another project that's really interesting that's going to be announced in a couple of weeks that I know you'll find interesting, Alex. And, you know, you might even want to do another interview with somebody about that, but I can't, again, it's got a moment where it's going to be made public, and that's coming up soon. And I'm involved with that too. So I'm not trying to be like intentionally secretive or anything. I just got certain things I can talk about and certain things I can't talk about. And I'm just hoping we do get to do a season 2, because I just think the making, exposing people, you know, a lot of the audience has never been, I mean, we're like insiders here. A lot of this audience has never been exposed to this stuff. And I think it's so wonderful to touch people and to open up some kind of door in a very basic level where they think, you know, that, well, maybe it is, death isn't the final end. Maybe there is something else. Just that alone. And especially now when we got so much loss all over the world with the coronavirus and everything, I just feel like it's just a wonderful thing to be able to give to the world, you know, to touch people in that way. And I think so many people are touched in that way. And maybe more of them, maybe some of them will dive in more deeply. And maybe some of them will also allow their own experiences to have more meaning and reality for them, things they might have dismissed in the past or things they wouldn't talk about. I can't tell you how many people are sending me messages, private messages on Facebook now, that just want to tell me their own experience. Some people have never talked about these things before. So it's also opening up a door that makes it okay to, just like with UFOs, you know, make it okay to take it seriously and to make it real. And oh, that's, I just feel like it's so important for people.
Just beautifully said. Beautifully said. And I think that is what it's all about. So,
and thank you for honoring this series and for all your comments and for watching it and inviting me to come on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Our guest again has been the incredible Leslie Kane. The series again is Surviving Death. Check it out on Netflix. You will not regret it. Thanks again, Leslie. Take care.
Great to be with you, Alex. Take care.
Thanks again to Leslie Kane for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I'd have to tee up from this episode is, what was your favorite episode in the series? See how I'm trying to lead you on to watch the series on Netflix, because it was really, really good. So what was your favorite? Let me know. Of course, place to do it at Skeptico Forum. I'd love to hear from you over there. I have a bunch of good shows coming up. Stick with me for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.